Up next is Pete's Ponderings on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Pete's Ponderings is a selection of Pete's candid commentary on everyday issues for Kiwis, taken from his show, Afternoons. Listen to the live broadcast of Peter Williams' afternoon show at 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Now, the much-trumpeted announcement over the weekend that New Zealanders will be able to get citizenship in Australia and all the benefits that go with it after 4 years of living there is a smart move by Australia, but if our Prime Minister really believes there won't be a speeding up of the exodus of young, talented Kiwis across the Tasman, a speeding up of the so-called brain drain, then, to quote one of the great lines of Australian cinema, he's dreaming. A comparison chart in the New Zealand Herald late yesterday afternoon put a few things in perspective, didn't it? A nurse earns $72,000 a year here on average. In Australia, that number, $96,000. A builder makes about $65,000 a year in this country. That's about $33 an hour. Over $100,000 in Australia for a builder, about $20 an hour more. And so it goes on. Teachers there have an average salary of around $100,000 a year. That's more than $30,000 a year more than the average here. Most worryingly, a specialist doctor in the public system in New Zealand makes around $137,000 a year. In Australia, it's over $200,000. Yes, you pay a bit more in income tax, but the cost of living and the cost of housing in some places in particular is much lower. If you're qualified and competent, why wouldn't you try your luck in Australia? After all, a place like us is desperate for skilled workers. Funnily enough, up until Saturday night, I thought a few of our Super Rugby players should go to Australia too, just to make the Aussie teams a bit stronger. But after the Highlanders lost to the Force in Perth, I've changed my mind on that one. Gee, it was sad to hear about Barry Humphries yesterday, and the tributes were many and gracious, except from that bunch of sad sacks who run the oh-so-politically correct Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which by coincidence finished yesterday. Humphries, along with the great British comic Peter Cook, were the mainstays of the festival when it started back in the 1970s. Being a Melbourne native, it was entirely appropriate that one of the funniest Australians ever should have been remembered in perpetuity through the Barry Humphries Award for the best show at the Melbourne Comedy Festival. Except that back in 2019, the PC and the Wokies couldn't cope with a funny old man who has charmed millions, mainly through an outrageous drag act, making a few derogatory remarks about transgenderism. So they took his name off the award. He died on Saturday night with 1 day left in the festival. Did the organisers have any inclination to get together some kind of tribute to a comic genius on the final day of the comedy festival? No. Between clenched teeth, the organisers did put out a press release saying, "We are saddened to hear of the passing of comic legend Barry Humphries. He will be remembered for his wit, his inimitable characters, and his biting satire. Our thoughts are with his family and friends." It was hardly a gushing tribute, really, was it, to the man who was a pioneer of the art of comedy in Australia? But that's the world we live in these days. It's lost its sense of humour. So RIP, Dame Edna and Sir Les, and Barry too. We laughed with you, we laughed at you, because you were funny. We need more people like you.
You're listening to Pete's Ponderings on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Now, considering the New Zealand Herald has taken money from the Public Interest Journalism Fund, which has as a condition of getting the money, the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi must be promoted, I'm amazed that the veteran writer and columnist John Rowan managed to get his opinion piece into the paper on Saturday, because he has highlighted again just what iwi influence in water could mean for this country. He's pointed out that the Te Mana o Te Wai statements issued by iwi are where the real power of the water legislation lies. The statements are in effect orders, which the new entities have to give effect to. In other words, they have to obey the order. It's nothing less than full iwi control of water. And Tuku Morgan, the Tainui bully boy, has said as much, gleefully. The Minister for Local Government, Karen McAnulty, has said, "Our courts have determined that Māori have an ownership interest in water." Now, that's just not true. In fact, many court judgments, like the one for ownership of Lake Taupo, particularly, specifically exclude the actual water in the lake. John Rowan's column is a timely reminder of what this government is trying to stealthily put into law. In fact, it has already done so with the current legislation. Rowan is most definitely not promoting the principle of partnership prescribed under the PIJF rules, and I commend him and his editor for that. And after his recent reading, here's his summary of what Governor Hobson and his colleagues presented to Maori chiefs in 1840. Quote, "They promised the chiefs autonomy over their tribes and territories within the laws and government of the new state. It was a prescription for self-governance rather than co-governance, Maori services for Maori needs, and majority rule for indivisible services like water." Now, this should be a significant election issue, but the very woke National Party as yet are not prepared to go anywhere near it. You really do fear for the outcome. You can get John Rowan's column on nzherald.co.nz. Rowan, by the way, spelt R-O-U-G-H-A-N. It is very much worth reading. Now, here's something that had me sighing with exasperation over the weekend. There are apparently 300 million people in the world who have colour vision deficiency, CVD, or colour blindness. That's around 4% of the world's population. How many of them are rugby fans? We don't know. But let's say, for matters of convenience, that 4% of the world's rugby fans have CVD. That means they struggle to tell red and green apart. But to make rugby more inclusive, World Rugby are changing their rules about what colours teams can wear at their tournaments, the most important of which, of course, is the Rugby World Cup. So from the 2027 event, teams must wear either a dark colour or a light colour to make differentiation between the teams easier for those with CVD, which means that when Wales, who play in red, face Ireland in green, both teams would have to change their jerseys to make them distinguishable for the tiny minority who are visually impaired. Even when the All Blacks play the Springboks, the famous green jersey of South Africa would have to be changed to something lighter, or else the All Blacks would have to play in white, which they've done often enough anyway. So the two most famous jerseys in international rugby might not be allowed to be on the same field at rugby's showcase event. That is madness, is it not? This year, apparently, the Wallabies can't wear their dark gold against Portugal because of a colour clash, and Portugal play in red. Well, it's a colour clash in the eyes of a tiny minority anyway. Look, I am all for inclusiveness, but when an inclusive move like this is going to annoy the vast majority of rugby fans, as well as paying no heed to the heritage and history of famous old international team jerseys, maybe the political correctness should just stop.
You're listening to Pete's Ponderings on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Now, some correspondence has come in to inbox at realitycheck.radio. This from David Anderson. David writes, "Peter, love your show and the station in general. Thank you. Just heard you talking about King Charles wanting to live to 100. But now that the Queen has passed, Charles' proclaimed affiliations with the WEF gives me the heebie-jeebies. And Prince William's appointment of Jacinda Ardern is an indicator to me that the royals now cannot be trusted. Your thoughts? Cheers, David." Well, David, I'm prepared to give the new king a go. Yes, in the past, as a prince, he's been a way more political as a commenter on social issues than his mother ever was. But I note that since he's been king, there's been barely a peep in that respect. I hope he keeps it that way. I'll continue to trust the royal family. I think they're important for New Zealand, although having Jacinda Ardern on one of their boards does make me suspect Prince William's judgment just more than a little. You can get in touch with me, inbox at realitycheck.radio. Now, I guess many of us have stayed at the Chateau Tongariro. If we haven't stayed there, we've probably driven past it. It's an absolutely stunning building, you'll know that, originally built back in 1929. And the country has admired it. It's been used on hundreds of tourist posters over the years, so many of us have stopped and taken a photo of it. But the point is, it's always been a financial noose around the neck of whoever has been the owner, whether it be the original owners, the Mount Cook Company back in the 1930s, the government through the Tourist Hotel Corporation, or the current owners, the Malaysian-based Car New Zealand. It's always been a financial struggle. For 31 of the 32 years up until 2017, it lost money. We don't know what the accounts have said since. I imagine it'll be a similar story. But now it needs at least $15 million worth of repairs to bring it up to earthquake code. That's money the owners are not prepared to spend, and not surprising. It's closed now, the Chateau, and maybe it will never open again as a luxury hotel. But what do we do with the building? The ultimate owner is the government through the Department of Conservation. So the Malaysians have walked away. Nobody can make money out of the place. The future of skiing on Mount Ruapehu is questionable. So what do we do? Is it time to face reality and just take the building down instead of throwing good money after bad? The heritage building supporters, of course, will be horrified. It is a Category 1 listed building. But does there not come a time when the land should be returned to the way it was 100 years ago? Yes, I know it is a nice-looking building, but it's in the middle of nowhere and it is impractical. Let's not have it keep costing the country millions.
You're listening to Pete's Ponderings on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Now, here's another one of those little scraps that in the overall scheme of things doesn't matter a heck of a lot, except for those who want to recognise and remember history. When I was a kid, a horse called Cardigan Bay captured the imagination of the country. He came from Mataura and became the first harness racer to win $1 million, which in the 1960s was just extraordinary. There was even a song written about him. Cardigan Bay won the Auckland Trotting Cup after being handicapped at the start 70 metres behind the rest of the field. He still got up and won. I remember listening to the commentary of that race. When was it? January of 1963. I was 8 years of age. I was caught up in it. Our family didn't like racing, but we still listened to the race. Cardigan Bay later raced successfully in the US, and all up, he won 80 races. He was brought back to New Zealand and died in 1988 at the grand old age of 32. He was buried at the Alexandra Park Raceway in Auckland, where he won that famous Auckland Cup. But now the Auckland Trotting Club is about to build a car park over where Cardi's grave is. And there's a big stoush developing about what should happen to the grave now and whether the horse's remains should be dug up and shifted elsewhere. To be honest, I don't know how many remains will actually remain after 35 years in the ground, but that's another question, isn't it? The New Zealand Trotting Hall of Fame wants to exhume Cardigan Bay and take him to their new home in Cambridge. But it's a question now of who actually owns a dead horse. And that's why there looks like being legal action over it. It's a sad postscript to a New Zealand equine hero. Let's hope the problem is sorted, and that New Zealanders can remember the feats of the great Cardigan Bay in a proper and respectful way. That is it from me for this Monday afternoon. Enjoy your Anzac Day tomorrow. Remember, they fought for our freedom and democracy. They are concepts we should really value. Under this government, though, can we be sure we will keep them? I am back on Wednesday. Enjoy your day.
You've been listening to Pete's Ponderings on RCR, Reality Check Radio. Remember, you can catch Pete's full show combining smooth sounds and candid commentary on everyday issues for Kiwis and the Peter Williams Afternoon Show on our live broadcasts, 1 p.m. Mondays, Wednesdays and Fridays. Right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.